Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Lori McGee, and it is my privilege to serve as worship associate for today's service. I'm joined today by Mike Kovancic, who is serving as our worship leader, as well as a guest musician. We are delighted to welcome you to this religious community. And another announcement this morning, we will have some images that we will play on our slideshow this morning that contain pictures of war. If those pictures upset you, or if you feel that they may cause you distress, please feel free to avert your eyes or to duck out during the sermon portion of our today's service. We light our chalice this morning in solidarity with those who suffer, with the poor, with the people living on the margins of society, and for everyone who fights for the right to be free. Anyone who's known me for any length of time knows that Frida Kahlo is my favorite artist of all time. She suffered in her life, there is no question, from polio that she contracted as a young girl to a tram accident where she was impaled by a pole, to her marriage to Diego Rivera, to the eventual amputation of her leg. Her suffering throughout her life was great. Her art is a reflection of that life. She began painting when she was in a full body cast as a result of her accident, and she had to lay flat for months at a time. Her father constructed a scaffolding above her bed in which she could paint looking up. She had a mirror. She painted herself. Last fall, I had the great joy of visiting the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, and I got to see a Frida Kahlo in person for the first time. And I was struck by how small and intimate her portraits are, no bigger really than a piece of paper. And so detailed. If you've ever seen her art, you know what I mean. It's so detailed, and yet it's so small. It invites you in. It invites you into that shattered life to see her, who she was. It was one of the most moving experiences of my life, and that is what art does. It moves us. It moves us emotionally, spiritually, mentally, physically, it calls us to action. Today's service is about that power, the power of art to move us deeply. Come, let us worship together.
This is the portion in the service where we have a silent reflection, and I just wanted a quick word about silence. The composer John Cage had a big interest in silence, both as a composer and as a practitioner in Zen Buddhism. In his study, trying to explore silence, he actually ended up at Harvard University, where they had something called an anechoic chamber, which is a chamber full of sound-absorbing materials that is what they thought was perhaps as close as you could get to silence on this planet. So John Cage went into the chamber, they closed the door, put him in there by himself, and pretty quickly he noticed that he was hearing sounds. He heard a high-pitched sound, kind of a ringing, and he heard a low-pitched drone. So when he left, he said to one of the engineers, "I don't think your chamber works, I heard some sounds." When he described them to the engineer said, "The high-pitched sound, that was your nervous system. The low-pitched sound, that was your circulatory system." This was a revelation for John Cage when he realized that there is no such thing as absolute silence on this planet. That in fact, every silence is a completely unique moment, and the world is full of countless unique moments of silence, each one a fingerprint. And that if we're mindful and accepting of the silence, we're in the moment. So let's take a moment of silence and see what this silence holds for us.
This morning, our prayer will be in musical form. So as you listen to the musical meditation, open yourself to the universe, to love, to light. Thank you. Revolution is the harmony of form and color, and everything exists and moves under only one law: life. Nobody is separate from anybody else. Nobody fights for himself. Everything is all and one. Anguish and pain, pleasure and death are no more than a process for existence. The revolutionary struggle is this process. It is a doorway open to intelligence.
Today's service is about art and the effect that it has on the world around us. I've been involved in the arts my entire life. I co-produced an opera. I've hung my work in countless galleries. I've released my work on about a dozen different labels, created and ran a film fest. I signed a contract recently to publish a book. But I have to say that you did not come here to watch some guy wave his resume around at you. It's not very interesting. What's far more interesting, I think, is to talk about one's inauspicious beginnings in those kind of areas. It's kind of like bad dating stories. There's always something good to find there. One of my earliest experiences in the arts was when I was about 5. I had this big, friendly white cat, and I used to draw pictures all over him. And then I'd send him out in the neighborhood as sort of a roaming art exhibit. Around that same age, 5, my mother gave me a plastic harmonica, and I used to play that thing for hours. And my mother used to tell everybody that I played melodies that were so beautiful that they could make a person cry. Looking back, I get why having to hear a kid play a plastic harmonica for hours at a time would make someone cry. But I was encouraged, and I went on to explore ventriloquism and writing and different things. I finally, at about age maybe 8 or 9, I got the idea to put together a variety show with the kids in my neighborhood. So I decided to stage this, both the rehearsals and the performance, at my friend Eric's house. And the reason was Eric had a big field behind his house with a huge elaborate jungle gym way in the back, and I knew that would be an excellent staging area. So that was one reason I chose Eric's house. The other was that Eric had the most negligent parents in the neighborhood. So we knew that any time we went to play there, we were good for a couple hours of unattended play and exploration. So we began developing our performance, and we pulled together what we had and realized pretty quickly, even with the balancing act, the stand-up comedy, the music, that we just didn't have enough to fill the amount of time that you would want for a performance. That's when a girl named Colleen stood up, and she said, "I have an act to share." And she immediately began running in excited circles around the jungle gym. And with each revolution, she would tear off another article of clothing and throw it in the air. And after several revolutions around the jungle gym, she came to a sudden stop, naked and sweaty, and said, "Ta-da!" Now, we knew that what we'd just seen was wrong and confusing. We also knew that it was totally compelling. So I decided that this is how we were going to end our performance. Because you think about this, what can you possibly do after a naked person goes, "Ta-da!" There is nothing. I defy you to think of anything that follows that. So we continued working on our piece. And somewhere in there, Eric's father came ambling back to check on us, to see what these darn kids were doing in his yard. Well, we were excited. He was our test audience. So we began performing for him. And he ruined our balancing act by yelling cautionary statements at us like, "Oh, watch your head," or "Hang on with both hands." Then he squirmed with boredom as we went through our stand-up comedy and our music acts. Then Colleen got up and began running in excited circles around the jungle gym, tearing off articles of clothing as she was going. And Eric's father immediately jumped into action, shut us down like a seasoned vice cop, and gave us an impressive impromptu speech on morality and human dignity. I wish I could say this was the only time I've heard that speech after one of my performances. I can't. Well, I continued in the arts, and I found myself playing clarinet in the band in 6th grade. The band was led by a Mr. Shellhammer. He was a kind of a skinny, nervous man with large bulging eyes. He was prone to angry outbursts and occasional acts of violence like pinching or slapping the kids. He was easily startled. When you think about it, who better to surround with a bunch of kids with noise-producing devices? He was prone to doing things like giving long speeches about communism and totalitarianism. He also had us perform a repertoire of material that was made up entirely of bombastic patriotic music. He would do these things called diaphragm exercises, where we would have the wind players stand very straight and play a long note, and then he'd come up behind us and shove us really hard. And what he said is that if you've built up your core muscles from enough practice, you won't fall. Or if you're like my friend Larry Stabnicki, you go headfirst into the woodwind section. So the terminology has changed. Of course, back then they called it a diaphragm exercise. Today they call that child abuse. But, you know, different times, different language. So, you know, I definitely looked at him as a source of terror in my life, Mr. Shellhammer. But, you know, as an adult, I also look back at him and I realize this was a man who loved music and had to go day after day and listen to us hack it to pieces. Teaching music to a bunch of kids like us must have been like trying to explain God to a room full of monkeys. So I have a little sympathy for him. Well, my band experience culminated in a big concert that we held in the gymnasium. You may have heard the acoustics of a gymnasium. It's about like sticking your head in a metal trash can and yelling as loud as you can. And all these poor tired parents came in after a long day of work and had to sit in this room that smelled like stale sweat and wrestling mats and listen to us play our repertoire made entirely of that bombastic, patriotic music. We started playing, and immediately I noticed something unusual happening. Because I would play a piece all the way through, and when I got to the end, I would stop and listen, and the rest of the group, they were had about 2 minutes left before they got to the end. I was beating them to the finish line over and over. I had broken loose in the space-time continuum. I looked up at Mr. Shellhammer, and I saw that silent rage, those bulging eyes. And it reminded me of the look that Eric's father gave when he came as our test audience to see our variety show. And I thought to myself, these arts are powerful. And that's when I realized the arts are in my blood.
Information this morning is one that most of you will probably be familiar with, Vincent by Don McLean. A little background. Vincent van Gogh was a Dutch missionary who was sent to assist the working people in the countryside. There he witnessed great suffering and struggle. Van Gogh eventually lost his financial backing as a missionary after he was accused of having excessive zeal. Undaunted, he took up art as his new mission. Unlike many painters throughout history who created idealized images of the aristocracy, Van Gogh made paintings that depicted the everyday life of working people. This was his ministry, to celebrate the lives of the common people. Van Gogh struggled with depression and epilepsy. Despite, or perhaps because of, these challenges, he worked in an intense fury, painting over 2,000 works of art in the last decade of his life. He left behind a huge body of work and sowed the seeds of expressionism along the way. The song Vincent by Don McLean describes this haunted, passionate man in ways that words alone cannot touch.
In 1941, the Third Reich dominated most of Europe. Every now and then, the Gestapo would burst into Pablo Picasso's studio in Paris. They would make disparaging comments about degenerate art, accuse him of harboring Jewish friends, and trash his studio. One day, an officer was in the middle of this process, and he came across a stack of postcards in Pablo Picasso's studio. They were postcards of this painting, Guernica. It's a ghastly image, screaming wounded horse, a woman with a dead child in her arms, a woman with her clothes on fire trying to get out of a burning building, severed head of a man. The Gestapo officer looked at the picture with disgust. "Did you do this?" he asked. Pablo Picasso, referring to the battle depicted in this painting, said, "Oh no, you did this. Go ahead, take one as a souvenir." Pablo Picasso was speaking the truth to power in that moment, because Guernica, of course, is not just a painting, it's a place. Basque country village in northern Spain. During the Spanish Civil War, this was a small village. It was not a military site. There were no military there. There was no industrial complex of any kind. What it was a progressive-leaning liberal population that generally tended to disagree with a fascist regime that was trying to take over. So the Nazis offered to help with this battle as a dry run for World War II. So on April 26, 1937, the Luftwaffe dropped 5,000 bombs on Guernica. Then as people were running for cover into the woods, they shot at them with machine guns, then dropped a host of incendiary bombs to finish the job. 1,645 unarmed citizens were killed, thousands others terribly wounded. This is what it actually looked like, not that different from the painting. The bombing commander described the battle this way: simply terrific, perfect conditions for a great victory. Pablo Picasso's painting was a dissenting opinion on this matter. And the Nazis took art very seriously. They had strong opinions about art. As soon as they slipped into power, they burned books, confiscated art, arrested writers, intimidated people who did creative activities of various kinds. Joseph Goebbels, who headed the ironically titled Nazi Ministry of Enlightenment and Propaganda, said, "The Führer loves art because he himself is an artist, and under his blessed hand, a renaissance has begun." In fact, it's true that Hitler was an artist. This is one of his paintings. As you'll see by his painting, he had some technical skill. He had composition skills. He knew how to work materials. But he was completely unoriginal, completely uninnovative. And interestingly, after looking at a number of Hitler's paintings, what you'll see is that the architecture is big and mighty, and the people are little insignificant blobs, which I think says a lot about his take on society. As the Nazis began doing everything they could to get rid of modern art, they began bringing in what they felt was real art to the people. This was mostly things like naked muscular people in heroic poses holding swords, as naked people often do. And they were very big on the romanticized, mythological view of humanity. This stood in stark contrast to the modern artists who expressed things like inner psychological states, insecurities, thoughts, ideas, even things that were complete abstractions. In an attempt to stomp out modern art, the Nazis put together a show of confiscated modern art. The show was called Entartete Kunst, which means degenerate art. This is the poster for that show. It was made up of 650 pieces of art. It included works by Marc Chagall, Vasily Kandinsky, Piet Mondrian, and Paul Klee, among many others. This show was seen by 3 million people, most of them coming to mock the art. In fact, was the most highly attended art show in human history. So here's a question. What were the Nazis so afraid of? They had tanks, they had machine guns, they had fighter planes, bombs, and they were worried about paintings, film, poetry. What they happened to know was that art does have the potential to create change. The reason is, we're surrounded at all times by information, by data. It isn't until we feel something, that we have emotion, that it takes on meaning. When you hear about a horrific battle, you say, "That's a shame." Until you see images of it or hear somebody share an expression of what it felt like to be there. There's a saying in therapy: we don't change until it hurts too much to stay the same. I'm a therapist. I work in the mental health field. I do a lot of trauma work. So people have been through horrific things. What we know about trauma is that if a person goes through a horrible thing and then they try to block it out of their mind, not think about it, it grows like a tumor until it takes over. Whereas if they stare that trauma head on, find a safe outlet to express it, it's like pointing radiation at that tumor and shrinking it down until it's insignificant. Often this is done through arts, through journaling, painting, collage. It's a safe outlet to explore those feelings beyond even what language can do in many cases. And this isn't just for therapy and trauma, just life in general. There's so much growth and healing that can come through exploring things, through creative expression. So that's the personal end of it. Then there's the spiritual end of the arts. Nearly every faith around the world and through history have used music, art, literature as part of their faith. This is not just ornamentation. This is an image to give an example. This is an MRI of a person having a peak musical experience. That's the right image. And on the left is that same person having a peak musical experience. I'm sorry, peak spiritual experience. And you'll see that they're virtually identical. The wiring for spirituality and the wiring for appreciating the arts is very similar. And being creative or experiencing somebody else's creative work can be a spiritual experience. Evolution and anthropology suggest that this has always been the case. Both visual art and music predate agriculture, and there's evidence they may predate language. Sophisticated flutes were found in France and Slovenia that were 53,000 years old. That's pre-Homo sapien. One thought is that evolution, the evolutionary purpose of the arts is to help us try on somebody else's experience, to imagine what they're going through and feel it as if we've gone through it. There's a part of the brain called the mirror neurons that help us do that. It helps us survive by trying on others' experiences and learning from them. And this is a spiritual concept. This is empathy. This is participating in the universal web of existence. This is the inherent worth and dignity of all people. This is getting a glimpse of the divine. So I've talked about the arts and how they can affect us on a social level, personal level, spiritual level. Here's somebody who embodies all three. This is a man named Sam Baker. Sam, as a young man, was an adventurer. He traveled around the world climbing mountains, going through rainforests and things, had all kinds of fun adventures. In 1986, he was in Machu Picchu, Peru, traveling by train. And at that time in Peru, there was a terrorist group called the Shining Path that was wreaking havoc all over the country. And little did Sam know, the train he was on had a bomb planted on the luggage rack just across over his head. He was sitting with a family of German tourists. And when the bomb went off, it killed everyone around him, some of them instantly and some slowly through agony. But Sam survived, barely. He had a brain injury, severed arteries in his thigh and arm. His hand was blown apart. He had hearing loss. During his recovery, he had gangrene and went through renal failure. During his recovery, though, Sam, who had noodled around with music a little bit and never really could come up with anything worth sharing, found himself flooded with songs. So you wonder what kind of songs a guy would write after being severely wounded in a terrorist attack. You know, maybe songs of revenge or anger or spite. Not at all. He wrote songs of compassion and forgiveness. He recognized things that, for example, when that bomb went off, perfect strangers ran into that blown apart train to pull him out to safety, knowing there could be other bombs that were going to go off. And that he was taken to a hospital where perfect strangers worked as hard as they could to help him pull through. So his music is about compassion, forgiveness, and healing. And during our offertory, you'll hear one of Sam's songs performed. I like when Sam's music is performed because I think every single time one of his songs is heard, it's another stand against terrorism. But there's one more point to make before we get to the offertory. One question you might ask is, so you talk about how the arts have made us aware and made us sensitive and made changes in the world. Then why, for example, are there still wars? Wouldn't we know better at this point? Well, I have good news. The number of people dying in wars has plummeted in the last several decades, to the point where statisticians are referring to this as one of the safest and most peaceful times in human history. You wouldn't know that from the hyperbolic news coverage. War still goes on, and it's horrible. We don't want to minimize that. But if we see it in perspective, these are number of people per 10,000 who were killed in battle. And the numbers are plummeting. And what is happening is, in the past, war was seen as a romantic and noble thing. Today, when a politician has to propose war, he does so in front of a skeptical and motivated voting public. So I'll give you an example of that. February 2003, Colin Powell went to the United Nations to explain the Bush plans for Iraq. What he was proposing was a preemptive war in a politically volatile part of the world in response to rumors and speculation from entirely biased and self-serving parties. What could possibly go wrong with a war like that? There was a problem right off, though, because the area where Colin Powell was to speak had a giant reproduction of Guernica on it. This was an embarrassment to them. In 1985, Nelson Rockefeller had donated this reproduction of Guernica in order to support the mission of the UN. So John Negroponte and Colin Powell had to scramble to figure out what to do about Guernica. They finally decided to cover it with a blue drape. Here they are, scrambling to cover Guernica. A diplomat said, "It would not be an appropriate background if the ambassador of the United States talks about war surrounded with women, children, and animals shouting with horror and showing the suffering of bombings." This means that decades after Pablo Picasso died, this painting continues to make warmongers wince with discomfort. Amen.
Music in this church is not something we lack, not even in the least. And today I'm grateful for all of our guest musicians, Angela Barziza Young, Jesse Young, Mark Alexander, and of course Mike. Our offering will now be gratefully received.
Go in peace, go in kindness, go in love, go in faith. Leave the day behind us. Day is done. Go in grace. Let us go into the dark. Not afraid, not alone. Let us hope by some good pleasure safely to arrive at home. Let us hope by some good pleasure safely to arrive at home.
In the words of Sam Baker, go in peace, go in kindness, go in love, go in faith.